evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Lucy Pony, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, December 5th, 2014. A top South Sudan diplomat wants the international community to reward his country for making progress at the Addis Ababa peace talks.
The message of our coming here was actually to relate that the peace process has progressed tremendously.
And Upper Nile State finally approves its 2014-2015 budget.
Passing this budget will be a cornerstone to what we are needed to do to our citizens. The interesting point was that this budget was delayed because of insecurity in our state.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Minister Barnaba Marial Benjamin was in the United States this week. He and his delegation, which included the minister in the office of the president, Awon Riak, held what Marial called extensive talks at the United Nations in New York and here in Washington with American and international officials. VOA fellow Michael Atit, South Sudan in Focus editor Karen Zaivogo, and I attended a news conference with Marial yesterday where he summarized his trip and why he made it. Michael, what did Marial say was the overriding reason for his visit to the United States?
Well, he said many times during his speech, which lasted at least half an hour, that he's here to convince South Sudan's international partners of this.
The message of our coming here was actually to relate that the peace process has progressed tremendously.
Why is that, the fact that the peace talks are moving forward, such an important message for him to convey to the United States?
Well, it's Karen here. I think it's because we know that the United Nations is considering imposing sanctions, targeted sanctions, on people that are deemed to be continuing, prolonging the violence in South Sudan. And that is something that Marial seems to want to head off.
What we hear, like you hear, is that the government and the rebels have failed to move the peace process forward, and therefore we must sanction them. But the story is not as it is. The peace process has moved forward. So if the reason of suggesting sanctions is that there is no commitment in the peace process, then one can understand it. But the facts on the ground is that, as I've related to you now, that both sides have agreed on everything to bring peace to the country, except on the issue of the structures of the transitional government. Then why not give the chance then? Why not help now, since it is the last lap? It's just like you are running a marathon and you are just left with 10 meters away.
He wants to convince South Sudan's international partners that the country needs help and not punishment. And he also said that several times.
When a friend in need is a friend indeed, you don't punish a friend when he's in crisis. What you do, you help get him out of crisis, and then after that, you can look for accountability. The Republic of South Sudan is committed to having peace in our country, and that the process has progressed, not the narrative that there is no progress in the peace process, and that we needed assistance. We needed help, not punishment.
Marial often chastised the media for misrepresenting South Sudan.
But what we want to clear with you, media people, don't say the delay in going to Addis is both sides. We now know clearly it is the rebels who are, because, and they have a reason, we understand it. They say, look, we have not yet consulted, give us time to consult.
And Michael, do you agree with what Marial is saying about the media, you know, not looking at South Sudan with a good eye?
Well, we have to. He also, in his speech, he credited actually the media reports on helping, you know, disseminating information about what situation is going in South Sudan, despite the fact that there is a conflict going on, being violated by either side or both sides, but he credited the media for that. I think that is also a good, you know, aspect, like looking at the media. So, but
he was more of saying that the media is not reporting accurately on the progress made at the peace talks in Addis Ababa.
I remember at the end of his speech, he said, "Not all the media."
That's
and
right.
You're just 3 months here. You were in South Sudan and went through some, you know, quite unpleasant experience.
Well, at the end, media bill is out, and we are hopeful that media situation in South Sudan will see a light that can, you know, create a conducive environment for journalists to work. Right now, there are some journalists still in detention, and some of them are nowhere to be seen. Some of them are still in hiding. So there is a lot of like worries about situation.
And let me get back to you, Karen. What is the gist of his talking yesterday? What do you think was the gist of his talk?
It could be characterized as a bit of a charm offensive. You know, he came over here and he went to the UN to try to get people on the side of basically the South Sudan government. So he's doing his job because, remember, he used to be the information minister. So he's used to being the spokesman, and he's also the chief diplomat as the foreign minister now. But on the media point, we did ask him, you know, how he's chastising the media so much. But we said, well, what are we supposed to do when we have trouble? And he said, well, you have the media law now, media laws, so you can just take the government to court.
Yeah, let's listen to that once again. Maybe it's a message that journalists in South Sudan would want to hear for themselves.
No, absolutely. The laws are there. The laws of the parliament has passed the media bills, which give the rights to the journalists for them to have. And if there is a government authority there trying to violate it, walk straight to your court and you get your rights.
Yes, but the thing is, if, as Michael says, a lot of journalists are in prison or have completely disappeared and we don't know where they are. So
or in hiding. Some are hiding.
In hiding as well. So we did say to him, well, if they're in prison or have completely disappeared, how are they supposed to bring a case against the government? How are they supposed to move forward and try to defend media rights in the country? There were several other things that he spoke about in addition to trying to stave off sanctions. He did say at the very end, as he was leaving, that he expects there will be peace soon. And that is a message that we've heard before from other government officials, including Michael Makuei. Michael Makuei actually gave you a date. He said December 15th.
Yes, he did. He did, actually. And when I pushed harder, he told me, let's be hopeful.
Yes. So, and I think that Marielle is also trying to be hopeful. And I think part of it is, part of their narrative is to try to convince the UN and the United States not to impose any more sanctions, to tell them, again, we need help, not punishment, which was
very clear in his speech.
Yeah, that was the theme of his message, actually, that we need rewards, not punishment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was South Sudan's Foreign Minister, Barnaba Marielle Benjamin, speaking to journalists here in Washington before returning to Juba yesterday.
We now move to Upper Nile State. The parliament there has passed its long-awaited 2014-2015 budget. Lawmakers hope the more than 7.4 million South Sudanese pounds budget, which is more than last year's budget, will improve delivery of services for its citizens. Jacob Achiek has more for VOA from Juba.
The State Assembly approved the £7.43 million budget today. The state government spokesperson Peter Ostrich said Upper Nile has been devastated by the year-long conflict and therefore more money is needed to reconstruct buildings and infrastructure destroyed during the violence. Ostrich says the state also added funds for food security in northern part of the state, where thousands of citizens believe for their safety.
You cannot deliver service without money. Money is one of the factors. I mean, the budget is not approved. There's no way to do anything. Passing this budget will be a cornerstone to what we are needed to do to our citizens. The interesting point was that this budget was delayed because of insecurity in our state.
Toy said that 9% of budget was located for 13 counties in the state, 11% for education to address the lack of school teachers and supply for rural children, and 7% was allocated for health. Toy said the remaining amount will be spent on various state agencies. Upper Nile State spokesperson Joseph Deng Forosh says the new focal budget takes into account the difficulties the state is confronting.
This was normally a yearly budget, but the exception that there is some amendment, some increase for the, to meet the present crisis, whereby that place and are also orphaned, thereby their father when they have been killed. This is not considered in that budget.
Deng said if peace returned to South Sudan, Upper Nile State might become the leading state in terms of revenue generation. He said Upper Nile State drives its revenue primarily from animal tax, agriculture tax, and oil. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek from Juba.
The International Criminal Court prosecutor withdrew crimes against humanity charges against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta Friday, citing a lack of evidence. VOA's Gabe Joslo reports accusations that the government did not cooperate with the court during its investigation also influenced the decision to drop the case.
ICC lead prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said Friday there is not enough evidence to prove the charges against Mr. Kenyatta beyond a reasonable doubt. Bensouda said Kenya's government failed to provide key documents to the prosecution, which undermined her investigations and had a severe adverse impact on the case. President Kenyatta was charged for his alleged role before he was president in the inter-ethnic violence that followed the 2007 Kenyan elections, leaving 1,100 people dead. Mr. Kenyatta's deputy, William Ruto, still faces charges at the ICC for similar crimes. In a message on an official Twitter account, President Kenyatta said he was excited by the news his case is being withdrawn, adding in a separate message, "My conscience is absolutely clear." Chief executive of the Law Society of Kenya, Apollo Mboya, says he was not surprised to see the case fall apart.
Of course, it's the quality of evidence. It's pure and simple. And the prosecutor said it. She didn't have evidence. So what did they investigate? It failed on that score.
Charges against Mr. Kenyatta were filed in January 2012, but the case began to unravel as witnesses started backing away from their testimony or refused to participate. Following a request to further postpone the proceedings, judges on Wednesday gave the prosecution 7 days to either withdraw the case or go to trial. Victims of the post-election violence still feel they have not received justice. Kefa Karoya, who works with a group for those displaced by the fighting, estimates some 44,000 people are still living in camps. He said many had already lost faith in the ICC process before Friday's announcement.
The hopes are seriously faded. Talking to several victims, they could not see the credibility of the case.
Mr. Kenyatta and Deputy President Ruto were accused of being on opposite sides of the ethnic fighting, but they banded together ahead of last year's presidential elections, issuing a joint call to reject the ICC as part of their campaign. The African Union has also backed Kenya's calls for the ICC to drop the charges and has accused the court of unfairly targeting Africans. Gabe Joslo, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello. I want to take a few moments to speak directly to you, the people of West Africa. On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives, and our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work, and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, UN wants more investigations into alleged mass rape in Darfur. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is it ever justified to remove a political leader from office by force?
Yeah, sometimes it should be allowed to remove some political leaders by force because some tend to over want to stay in power. But again, on the other hand, there should be some other maybe rules that people should undertake when they're removing somebody from power.
No, it is not justified. This is because they have a limit. Usually they have term limits, so I really see you don't need to use force to push them out if that person really has common sense in them.
Yeah, it is justifiable. Some people are just collapsed and then you remove them. That's fair to them, rather than letting them being on the position and living the life of many people.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Yesterday, we brought to you the story about fallout from the alleged mass rape that occurred in Darfur last month and the Sudanese ambassador's reaction denying the mass rape occurred. Now, a senior United Nations official says further investigation is required into allegation of mass rape in Sudan's North Darfur region last month. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashar has more.
UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ladsous told the UN Security Council that due in part to the heavy presence of Sudanese soldiers and police during a fact-finding mission's visit to Tabat on November 9th, further investigation is necessary to verify allegations that 200 women and girls were raped there by Sudanese troops the last 2 days of October. He is heard here through an interpreter.
I would underscore that only an independent investigation by UNAMID will address the concerns over these serious allegations and therefore urge the government of Sudan to grant UNAMID immediate and independent access to Tabat and its population so that these reports can be verified.
UNAMID is the acronym for the joint UN African Union mission in Darfur. The report of the mass rape was made on Radio Dabanga, a Netherlands-based station that broadcasts to Darfur. The allegations were attributed to a village elder. The Sudanese government denied UNAMID access to the village for more than a week before allowing a team in on November 9th. Subsequent requests for a small team to return to Tabat have not been granted. Sudan's UN ambassador, Ramatullah Mohammed Asman al-Noor, told the council that the government did not interfere with the UNAMID team that visited Tabat on November 9th, and that if it did not like the conditions for the investigation, the team should have left instead of going ahead with the interviews. He dismissed the rape allegations as false and propagated by an opposition radio station. He's heard here through an interpreter.
Is it conceivable that 200 women and girls can have been raped in a village without anybody avenging the honour of their daughter or their wife, or without anybody reporting the incident?
The peacekeeping mission's relationship with Khartoum has been fraught with difficulties, including attacks on peacekeepers and constraints on their movements in Darfur. In the latest development, the government last week demanded two UNAMID human rights experts immediately leave their Khartoum office. Peacekeeping Chief Ladsous told the council that they had no choice other than to comply, but that it was unacceptable. He also noted that Khartoum has publicly called for UNAMID's exit, noting it is not a matter of UNAMID leaving tomorrow, but an exit strategy must be agreed to. The Darfur mission has nearly 16,000 soldiers and police and costs $1 billion a year to run, but has been widely criticized for years for not being more effective. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Food security efforts in the Ebola-stricken countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have gotten a financial boost. The Africa Solidarity Trust Fund has awarded a $1.5 million grant to support farmers and those living in rural areas. However, the grant is only a fraction of what UN agencies say is needed. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The trust fund, managed by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, opened for business in 2013, with donations from several African countries. It currently finances projects in 30 nations. Ariella Glini is Senior Program Advisor for the Global Food Security Cluster, which is co-led by the FAO and the World Food Program.
Solidarity Trust Fund is a very particular trust fund where African countries come forward and put together resources to help development or emergency activities that support African countries. So from that perspective, it's unique. Now in the context of the joint effort to control Ebola and also the consequences and impact, it has just approved a contribution for the three most affected countries.
The Trust Fund's new $1.5 million grant will be equally distributed in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. It will support the UN agency's regional response program in assisting about 45,000 people over the next year.
The main focus of these activities is to assist households, especially farming households, which have been affected by the impact of the Ebola crisis. It will also address social mobilization and training, so in terms of awareness, to stop the spread of the Ebola virus disease.
Glini explains why the program aims to strengthen the savings and loan mechanisms at the community level.
To kickstart some of the activities in terms of farming, marketing, which have been most affected, we have to keep in mind that the indirect effects of the Ebola crisis in terms of access to the fields, access to remote locations, the transport, the simple transport of goods and agricultural produce from one area to the other has been very heavily affected. And therefore, the saving schemes is considered to be one very instrumental support, especially for the communities which have to rely really much on their own resources and capacities.
The FAO and WFP will soon get the results of the latest food and crop assessments in the Ebola-affected countries.
These activities to consolidate the evidence, the available data and facts, not only the impact on the agricultural sector and production, but also the impact on livelihood and at community level. Of course, the focus remains on the health side to stop the spread of the virus, but actors come together also to mitigate or prevent some of the negative consequences of the virus.
Last month, the Food and Agriculture Organization appealed for $30 million to deal with Ebola's threat to food security. Glini says there's been little response so far.
The funding received from FAO side stands at little more than $3.3 million. This leaves a major gap of over $26 million. Part of these resources FAO has provided from its own technical cooperation funding and internal resources.
Those internal resources include the new grant from the Africa Solidarity Trust Fund. FAO and WFP food security assistance is expected to continue in the Ebola-affected countries through 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And the U.S. is awarding 15,000 grants to five U.S. universities that are partnering with Ethiopian schools on research and development projects. The initiative by the State Department and the Department of Education is designed to strengthen the skills of faculty and administrators in both countries. One grant awarded to the University of Maryland and Ethiopia's Debre Brihan University will be used to train Ethiopian women on how to grow crops as part of an effort to address food insecurity. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
Through classroom instruction and work on demonstration farms, the University of Maryland will provide training on how to grow food throughout the year with a goal of improving food security. University Technical Advisor Becky Ramsing says they hope to help women in Ethiopia who may have had limited access to training opportunities.
If you give the woman the resources, those resources will directly go to the family. And when women are given added income or able to raise more food, that directly relates to the children and the education and the nutrition of the child.
She says the goal is to train staff members at Debre Brihan University who will then teach women in useful techniques such as growing food in small spaces.
Some of these women don't have access to land. How can we do container gardening, vertical gardening, livestock like small poultry?
Sige Mariam Bashay is a program facilitator and dean at Debre Brihan. She says an overall goal is empowerment.
Empowering women is empowering the whole population or empowering the society.
Debre Brihan facilitator Hailu Tarifa says only men are traditionally taught farming in some parts of the country.
There is cultural differences. In Ethiopia, all the regions do not have the same culture. There are regions that women are not allowed to go for agricultural practices.
Sige Miriam Bashay hopes the women who are trained will in turn assist other women.
I hope in the near future, women in the project become the community educator.
The other U.S. university grant recipients are Brown, Bowling Green State, Ball State, and the University of North Texas Libraries. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Lucy. U.S. President Barack Obama is nominating former Deputy Pentagon Chief Ashton Carter as the next Secretary of Defense. President Obama announced the choice at the White House this past hour. Carter, a physicist and high-tech weapons expert, served as Deputy Defense Secretary from 2011 to 2013. In that role, he was the Pentagon's top weapons buyer. Carter is said to hold bipartisan support in Washington. If confirmed by the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, he will replace Chuck Hagel, who resigned under pressure last month after just 2 years on the job. A Sunni militant commander in Syria who has pledged his allegiance to the Islamic State group has threatened to retaliate against Lebanese Shiites due to the arrest of his wife and children in Lebanon. In a video statement, Abu Ali al-Shishani said Shiite women and children will be legitimate targets for his militants. Shishani is flanked by two masked gunmen in the video, which could not be independently verified as authentic. His real name is Anas Sharkas, according to Lebanese authorities. And finally, the United Nations Refugee Agency says authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo have suddenly closed a camp for internally displaced people, forcing them to leave and go home. The United Nations Refugee Agency says 2,300 people living in the Kiwanja IDP camp in the eastern Congolese city of Rutshuru have suddenly become homeless. It says people were forced to leave the camp on December 2nd without warning and told to go home. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that marks the end of our show for this Friday. We want to leave you in a weekend dancing mood with this song, Potential, by Radio and Weasel.
Hey, yo. This is General Oz alongside Radio and Weasel. And this is going out to all the potential ladies in the world. True.
This is kana mange Kalipa ize kupianga Mumba Umushe wazo ona supisika Muchitenge Nangu muchitambala Awe supisika Bambiri Bama kapita Siva makaona Awe Ndawa patupi ndalama palipe Ansa Simona Veliona, Alina Potential,
we have been listening to Radio and Whistle with that song, Potential. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Lucy Pony in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.